Company Radio.
It's about real people.
Not sound bites.
Not more talking heads.
Not on this show.
Interchange is a community access media forum fostering unfiltered open dialogue on the people, issues, and events impacting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Conversations that challenge the ways we perceive the world around us.
Real people.
Real issues.
This is your forum.
This is Interchange.
Good evening and welcome to Interchange. My name is Ashley Beeman. Our show tonight focuses on activism. In our second segment, Hoosier Timothy O'Donnell joins us to share his views against capital punishment. First, though, Dr. Rob Stone has come into the WFHB studios to share his thoughts on the ongoing issue of national health care and the single-payer system.
Thank you, Ashley. This is Chad Carruthers in the studios of Interchange here at WFHB Bloomington Community Radio. And as you heard, we have an activism theme tonight, and we're talking about life and death. In the second half hour, we'll speak with Timothy O'Donnell on the death penalty. In this first half hour, we are in the studio with Dr. Rob Stone, who is a local emergency room physician and the founder of Hoosiers for a Common Sense Health Plan. This is a group of Indiana citizens supporting a publicly financed single-payer universal health care system. Dr. Stone, no stranger to WFHB airwaves. Welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you, Chad.
Let's talk a little bit about your background, and then we'll jump into Hoosiers for a Common Sense Health Plan. You've been an emergency room doctor here at Bloomington Hospital for a long time.
28 years, 1983.
And we've heard you say many times on WFHB that your role in the emergency room, seeing the people that come in and people who have waited too long to come in, that our present healthcare system is like a safety net because it's full of holes.
Mm-hmm.
Explain that.
We are the one place, of course, that doesn't check your wallet before we will see you, and you don't have to have health insurance. All you got to do is show up at our door, and we'll take care of you no matter what you've got. Now, the other side of that, of course, is we do send people a bill, and the bills can be pretty high, but we take care of everybody, and so that does mean we're part of this thing called the safety net. And you know, I'm always reminded when I say that both our governor, Mitch Daniels, and his favorite president, George W. Bush, both said on more than one occasion that, you know, we already have universal health care in this country because anybody can go to the emergency room 24/7. Now, you know, you can't, they said it with a straight face, but I can't even repeat that with a straight face myself, because that's so ludicrous. You can go to the ER, but that's not universal health care. You know, we can try to patch people up, and we do. And you know, I've had people come into the ER who've been walking on a broken ankle for a couple of days, and they say, "Doc, do you think it's broke?" And I look at this, you know, purple swollen ankle, and I think, "Oh my gosh, it sure looks like I need to get an X-ray." And they say, "Doc, I can't afford an X-ray," you know, and on and on. And of course, sometimes it's worse than that. You know, diabetics who wait until they're in diabetic coma to come to the emergency room, and on and on and on.
So your time, your many years in the emergency room, then examples like that are part of what led you to this path of activism. Can you talk about when you first made the decision to take an inactive role in mm-hmm. trying to change mm-hmm. the healthcare system that you were clearly seeing first person was failing?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's kind of like the old story about they keep seeing bodies in the river, and so they keep figuring out better ways to help pull these bodies out of the river, and then somebody starts saying, "Well, maybe we ought to go upstream and see where these bodies are falling in," and that's really what led me to this. I mean, I've had kind of a bit of an activist bent my whole life, but in about 2005. I started realizing that the healthcare system was just getting worse, and it was getting worse steadily and progressively, and I was seeing the effects of it. And I thought, you know, we really need to do something different. I had been a member of a national organization called Physicians for a National Health Program, PNHP. I'd been a member of PNHP for 5 or 6 years at that point, but it was really in 2005, there was an event locally called Bridging the Gap that was organized by some local folks, including Dr. Mary Mayhern, who's a family doctor here in town. Mary asked me to speak, and I put together a little speech, and it went so well that I started getting more invitations to speak after that, and I said, well, you know, we really ought to put together an organization. And we started with one doctor from Indianapolis, myself, and local retired IU faculty person, Milton Fisk. The three of us got together, and we started meeting with other people, and we grew this thing. And so now, although we're based in Bloomington, Hoosiers for a Common Sense Health Plan, HCHP, has chapters in Fort Wayne and a couple other cities in northern Indiana, in Indianapolis, in Nashville, Indiana, Columbus, New Albany, Evansville, Terre Haute. We've got, I think, 11 chapters throughout the state. We have a mailing list with almost 3,000 active emails. We're pretty active, but this is we're still, you know, our most active center is here in Bloomington, as it usually is with things like this in Indiana.
And you guys are online at hchp.info.
Yes.
Describe just in a nutshell the basic platform of Hoosiers for Common Sense Health Plan.
So HCHP is the Indiana chapter of PNHP, Physicians for National Health Program. Although PNHP is primarily a physician organization, HCHP is open to anybody. And you basically join by going online and signing up. And you can send us money if you want, but it's not required. We're free. Our basic platform is that healthcare should be basically free at the point of access. There should not be financial barriers to people getting healthcare. And that's an old idea that somehow kind of sounds crazy and radical in the United States today, but it's the idea that most people in the world have fairly small, limited, or no barriers to healthcare in the developed world, in the civilized world, in the industrialized world, in Europe or Australia or Canada or New Zealand, and so, of course, healthcare isn't ever free, but it's we think that financial barriers to healthcare, including cash up front or big copays and things like that, even if you have insurance, impair the ability of people to get good healthcare. And so we favor a system based on Medicare. And Medicare is going to have its 46th birthday, I think, coming up on July 30th. Mm-hmm. And Medicare is the universal single payer, you could call it, system we've had in this country since 1965 for anybody age 65 and above, and also a lot of disabled people. So once you're 65, you're automatically in Medicare. And there are some copays and some costs associated with Medicare, but for the most part, it's paid for with taxes that you paid, with contributions that you paid while you were working. Mm-hmm. And this is how most other countries run their healthcare systems, and most other countries end up actually spending way less than we spend per person per year, about half per capita what we spend. And most other countries actually have better health care than we do in the United States. And that is kind of a shock to people, because everyone thinks we've got the best health care in the world. And we should, because we got the most expensive health care in the world. but actually, you know, the World Health Association ranks us, I think, 37th in the world, of the world's healthcare systems, below Costa Rica.
Wow.
So we've got a crummy healthcare system, although if you're really rich, we've got a great healthcare system, but we just leave way too many people out. Something like 51 or 52 million Americans today don't have any health insurance.
So the basic idea is you take the Medicare example, the Medicare platform, and you extend that to all.
Right. And that's what's called a single payer system. And single payer is kind of a jargon word that isn't necessarily easily understood. But if you think of it like Medicare, which is publicly financed, it's tax-based financing, but it's privately delivered. When I see a Medicare patient, I see them like I'd see anybody else. I send a bill into the government and I get paid for it. Medicare, we could talk about its faults and its weaknesses and whatnot. It could be improved. But it's not a bad system. It runs about 3% overhead as opposed to Anthem WellPoint, the huge insurance company, which is based in Indianapolis, and it runs, you know, closer to maybe 20% overhead in a lot of its insurance function. It runs at least 15 to 18% overhead. A lot of money being spent there that's going for things like paying people to deny care, to refuse coverage. And then, of course, the CEO, whose reimbursement last year was $13.4 million, I think, give or take a half a million here and there. A lot of money.
Wow. We are speaking with Dr. Rob Stone, a local emergency room physician and founder of Hoosiers for a Common Sense Health Plan. This is Interchange. I'm Chad Carruthers. Speaking of Anthem WellPoint, a few years back ago, you bought some stock in WellPoint so that you could show up at the shareholder meetings and file petitions? Or what is it that you bought stock in WellPoint for? Why'd you do that?
Well, the old-fashioned answer is we wanted to go speak truth to power. And by buying 5 shares of stock, then we bought it jointly, my wife and I, so we could both then have the right to go to the shareholder meetings and speak to them.
Uh-huh. And have you been welcome at those meetings?
No. They're really afraid of us. They don't really like anybody speaking, pointing out their faults and their problems. We also put together a shareholder resolution. Uh-huh. And because WellPoint, or the card in my pocket, says Anthem, I've got Anthem coverage, and I'm an Anthem provider. If you're sick and have Anthem, you can come see me, and it'll be covered. But I'm also an Anthem shareholder. And so we looked back at WellPoint or Anthem's original roots. It was it was Blue Cross of Indiana many years ago, which had a charitable mission. It was a nonprofit, and it basically existed to try to help people get health care and to help healthcare providers get paid, and it had a very different mission now. It was not for profit. And so we put together a shareholder resolution that Anthem should fund a feasibility study for returning to its charitable nonprofit roots. And actually, the first year that we had this submitted, which was at the shareholder meeting in May of 2010, we got 9.6% of the shares voted for our resolution. Now, we kind of caught Anthem unawares, WellPoint unawares that year. They didn't see us coming, and they were pretty shocked that we got that huge a number of votes, which was, I forget, 30 some million shares were voted for our resolution. So they went out and really worked hard this last year to squelch us, and we only got a little over 1 million votes out of millions and millions. So we got less than 1% of the vote this year. So our resolution to turn them back to nonprofit has been totally squashed by them, which is not surprising. But we still own our stock, so we'll go back next year and we will.
You're gonna keep trying.
We'll raise our concerns and our complaints, but we think that their basic business model. See, the business model of a huge for-profit health insurance company is that they want to bring money in, which is take premiums from people. And they don't want to pay money out, which is to pay for people when they get sick. Now, I went to medical school to take care of sick people, you know? So I find myself at diametric odds against the insurance companies because that's how they become profitable now. I just think it's crazy to have for-profit health insurance companies. I think it's against our interest. We're the only country in the world. We are the outlier in the world with for-profit health insurance companies. There are a lot of companies that don't necessarily have the government pay for health insurance. There's a lot of private health insurance in the world, particularly in Germany and Switzerland, for example. But those insurance companies are nonprofit. They're very heavily regulated. So there's a lot of different ways you could get to universal coverage. And we've got to find some way to get there.
Well, being that we do have these for-profit insurance companies and being that they do make so much money and they have so much political power, you're facing a tremendous obstacle, tremendous resources working against you.
Well, it's true. The insurance companies are very, very powerful. They've spent tens of millions of dollars in direct campaign contributions for the last election cycle. And they have spent hundreds of millions of dollars for lobbying. They funneled $100 million alone through the Chamber of Commerce to fight against the health care reform bill that they allegedly were in favor of. You know, we could talk about the Affordable Care Act, or sometimes called Obamacare, although I like to call it Rombamacare, because Governor Romney, when he was the Republican governor of Massachusetts, right, really pioneered the whole idea of what now people call Obamacare.
Right.
And our position is that the Democratic bill that passed, the Affordable Care Act, the ACA, just didn't go far enough. And in fact, although it put some limits on the health insurance industry, it also provided them with some big subsidies, because they're going to, you know, they've mandated that everybody buy their product, which I think is a defective product. Mm-hmm. So I really don't think the Affordable Care Act went far enough. And the insurance companies are now trying to cripple it and take out the few little parts of the bill that that they didn't agree to. And meanwhile, a lot of the people on the Republican side are trying to just scrap the whole bill, which is unfortunate, because there are some good things in the bill. Mm-hmm. And any bill that would offer coverage to, you know, roughly half of the current uninsured can't be all bad.
Sure. And it's, I mean, I think we can all agree that it's unfortunate that politics has to play such a role in such a fundamental quality of life, you know, mm-hmm, human rights issue, really.
Yes, even. I think it's a human rights issue. I agree. But these insurance companies are very, very powerful. And, you know, there was a famous old organizer called Saul Alinsky, and he used to say, well, they've got the money, but we got the people. I mean, the only way to turn this thing around is good old grassroots organizing and working, and that's what we do. Because if people just get discouraged and say, the corporations have all the power, then that's a self-fulfilling prophecy. You know, if you just give up and say, I'm just going to go home and watch TV and put down a six-pack, nothing is going to change.
Sure. Well, let's talk about a place where change is happening for the benefit, for the better, and that's Vermont.
Okay.
We're talking with Dr. Rob Stone, emergency room physician here at Bloomington Hospital. This is Interchange. I'm Chad Carruthers. Stay tuned also. In about 10 minutes or so, we'll switch gears and have Timothy O'Donnell in to talk about the death penalty. So just before we went on air, you were mentioning that there's some interesting stuff going on in Vermont.
Vermont is it's way up in New England there. There's only a little over 500,000 people in the whole state.
Right.
And they've got, the state that small has two senators like every other state, but only one member of the House of Representatives. And they've got an old sense up there of we're not afraid to try things. And so with the support of their two senators and their congressperson and a governor named Peter Shumlin, who ran both in the Democratic primary calling for Vermont to set up a single-payer universal system within the state, and then ran full tilt on that same platform against his Republican opponent in the general election, and he was elected governor. And he had, before he was elected governor, he was in the legislature and had worked to pass a single payer bill through the legislature, and had not been able to get it passed the previous governor. So now, as the new governor, when he came in 2011, when he was inaugurated, he said, "We're going to work for a single payer bill in Vermont." The other thing that they did in Vermont was, before he came in, while he was still in the legislature, he did get the legislature to fund a feasibility study that was headed by a Harvard professor named William Shao. He's a Chinese-American professor who was himself very much involved in helping to set up the Universal Plan in Taiwan that they instituted in 1995. So Professor Shao is a brilliant man with lots of experience all over the world, and he looked at Vermont and actually had spent the better part of the year working up a feasibility study about how to do it. And he basically said, here's how you can do it. It is feasible. We can cover everybody. We can actually save money. And so he presented his study, and then the legislature started putting together a bill. Now, there's a problem that there are a couple problems that they run into in Vermont, which are because it's one state as opposed to the whole country. And the biggest problem is that the aforementioned Affordable Care Act has in it a statement that no state can set up their own independent state system, like a single state single payer system, until 2017.
Oh, really?
Yes. And that got stuck into the Affordable Care Act, and it's there. So the Vermont congressional delegation is trying to get a waiver to move that up to 2014, and they've actually got some Republicans who are co-sponsoring their bill, but it's not the situation in Washington is so partisan right now. Mm-hmm. That bill is going nowhere. Mm-hmm. So in the meantime, what they're doing is setting up the foundation that can move into a single-payer system and setting up their exchange. You remember part of the Affordable Care Act is that every state will set up a healthcare exchange to help people buy insurance. They're setting up their exchange in such a way that it can turn into the mechanism to run a state single-payer system. And they've set up an independent advisory board, which is going to be a very interesting thing to really look at hopefully to depoliticize things a little bit and just look at the most practical ways to implement their system. So they've passed a bill, it's been signed into law. They've still got some significant challenges and some delays, and it may not be till 2017 that they can make the whole thing happen. But it's very exciting because you know, Social Security started in one state and spread to the rest of the country. Women's suffrage, women's right to vote started in one state and mm-hmm. spread to the rest of the country. And in healthcare in Canada, way out in Saskatchewan, that was the first state, the first province in Canada to move to their single-payer universal system, and then it spread to the rest of the country.
Huh. So Vermont's laying the groundwork. Are there? Could we see a number of states when 2017 comes? A number of states jump on that?
We could. And actually, the other really exciting thing is California. Now, in California, actually, in the last 4 years, twice, both houses of their legislature have passed single-payer bills in California, and they've both been vetoed by Schwarzenegger when he was the governor of California.
Uh-huh.
And so currently the governor is Jerry Brown.
Right.
And although Jerry Brown has been closed-mouthed and has not taken a position on what he would do about a single-payer bill if it passed again, when he was governor before, at that time, he was on record as being in favor of single payer. Hmm. So there's a real chance that California might follow Vermont's lead, and there is a bill in their legislature right now. I think it's moving its way through the Senate right now. And so we could see some really exciting things happen in California as well.
Very interesting information on the healthcare front nationally from Dr. Rob Stone, our guest tonight on Interchange. One of our two fine guests tonight on Interchange. Rob, we have just a few minutes left. You know how the time just flies when we get together in the studio. I wanted to reserve just a few minutes here at the end for you to talk about going back to Hoosiers for Commons and South Plan and what... What people listening here in our six county region, what they can do and how they can support or join HCHP. As we close, what information would you share with our listeners?
Okay. You know, one of the best things about this Affordable Care Act is that it brought the health care issue really into the forefront, and people understood pretty well that the only way we can really deal with health care is the government's going to have to play a larger role, and we can't just leave it to the private sector. And so what we're really looking at right now is really a battle for the soul of American health care. And it's a battle that really affects our pocketbooks. And I would really want to try to reach out to, if there are any Tea Party folks out there listening, sometimes you just can't give everything to the marketplace. I mean, we decided a long time ago in this country that you can't buy judges, you know, and you can't buy kidneys, and you can't sell babies. You know, not everything is necessarily best left to the marketplace. And the marketplace in healthcare has gotten totally distorted, and it's not serving us. We need more. It's one place where we need some more regulation. We need to put things under a little bit better control. We need to go back to a lot of the nonprofit roots that we used to do our healthcare system with, because things are getting worse instead of better. And so we've got to fix this thing. And I mentioned before, you know, that it's easy to get discouraged and just to feel like, oh, just all the politics is so bad. But the antidote to despair is action and activism and coming out and getting involved in democracy. And we still have a democracy in this country. Some people say we got the best democracy money can buy. But I don't think that's the case. I think we've seen that. We saw that in the presidential election last time. People can get out and make a difference, but you got to get out and do something. So I'd encourage you to go to our website, Hoosiers for a Common Sense Health Plan. That comes out to hchp.info, I-N-F-O. We have meetings in Bloomington the second Wednesday of every month at 5:30 at First United Methodist Church. And you can find all that info on our website. So come out and check it out. And, you know, WFHB listeners tend to be people who do get involved. But we got to get involved in this, because we can't just sit back and let it happen to us.
Dr. Rob Stone, always a pleasure.
Thank you, Chad.
Thank you for coming into the studio tonight. Stay tuned in just a few minutes. We'll have Timothy O'Donnell here on Interchange. I'm Chad Crothers. This is WFHB Community Radio for South Central Indiana.
Our second segment, Timothy O'Donnell sits down at the firehouse to talk about his views against the death penalty.
Good evening. Hey, my name is William Morse, and I'm here with Timothy O'Donnell. Timothy is an activist who opposes capital punishment, and he was kind enough to stop into our studios for a conversation about capital punishment. Hello, Timothy.
Well, hello, William. Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you here. Timothy, how did you come to oppose capital punishment?
Well, William, my journey began about 10 years ago. I began studying, asking the big questions. You know, as I entered into sort of middle age, a lot of the big questions, who am I? Where do I come from? Where are we going? What's the meaning of life? That started a journey for me, an intellectual journey. I went to back to school, earned an undergraduate degree in Catholic theology, and then also pursued a master's in Catholic life and thoughts. So sort of the philosophical and theological tradition, intellectual tradition of the Catholic Church. And then I've also done some graduate work at Notre Dame. So these issues about the human person, there's really one fundamental question for me that I pursued. What is the true value and worth of the human person? And from that, other issues began to spring, answers or possible answers to other questions began to arise.
That's a big question. What is the true value and worth of a human being? How did that lead you toward the death penalty?
Well, my position is that the human person is of inestimable worth. There is no such thing as a disposable human being. Every human being has a dignity that's endowed by virtue of the kind of thing that we are. It's not an achievement. Our worth stems from our human nature, our ability to reason, our ability to reflect, our gifts and talents. We're intentional. We have a free will. We're able to be responsible for our actions. We're able to think about the consequences and deliberate and choose freely. These are things that set us apart from any other creature on the planet.
And yet, in spite of those gifts, that ability to reflect, the reasoning, we commit heinous crimes that create this controversy, that create a debate on whether someone should live or die.
Yes, that's true. And when we think about the human person, we think about our ability to, we have an intellect, we have free will, and yet we see in our own lives, the lives of our family often, our friends, in our communities, often our intellects are darkened, meaning that we haven't received the full intellectual formation that we should or ought. We can't fully see or understand all of the consequences or permutations of that. But also our wills are weak. We often give in to temptation. I myself, I have a affinity for cheeseburgers, and I probably should not give in to that, but I do. And I don't mean to diminish our subject by any means.
Absolutely.
But we can see by just our everyday lives, we can turn on the television, look at the news, and we can see human beings that we have a capacity for great good and a capacity for great evil.
You know, at the present time, 34 states in the United States have the death penalty, including Indiana.
Yes.
And what we're really talking about in some ways is the power of the state to execute a human being.
So my position on the death penalty is, I guess I would categorize myself as a minimalist. On one end, there are those who I would categorize as maximalist. In other words, we should look for the maximum amount of opportunity to administer capital punishment. Therein reigns in almost a vengeance, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. I would say in our country, though, my position is one of respecting that the state has the right and obligation, actually, to protect the common good, to protect its citizens from harm. That's an integral, intrinsic role of the state. And therefore, I leave open the possibility of that the state has the right to administer capital punishment. Now, the question then becomes of, well, when and under what circumstances? And there, I think, is where the debate happens. That's the conversation that we need to enter into.
Take us further down the road of that debate. That debate is what? What's the question?
Well, the question is really, if the death penalty and capital punishment is at the disposal of the state, how and when should we administer it? Under what circumstances? And what effects does it have in terms of punishment, the ends and goals of punishment? What's the purpose of punishing crime, even capital crimes? And then I would say also, what's its effect on society? What's the moral impact of a society that executes its citizens?
I think when we think of those, maybe stereotypically, which of course is going to imply maybe bad thinking, but maybe our particular model of a person who really opposes the death penalty is that they oppose killing another human being under any circumstance. Is that where you stand?
That's not where I stand. Where I stand is that whenever possible, we should use bloodless means, such as imprisonment, to incarcerate individuals. Let me tell you why I hold that position. I would say that capital punishment can be brought, can be used in cases where there is a serious concern that an individual might escape, be let loose on society, and inflict further violence, harm, damage upon other persons. In cases like that, the death penalty would seem to me to be appropriate. However, with today's penal system and the prisons that we build, escape or that happening is very, very low. Therefore, I think our position should be to minimize the use of the death penalty, where it's really going to be very difficult for me to imagine when we would even apply that. And let me get to a point that you raised earlier, William, around this idea of punishment. Now, I'll put forth for our audience four things to consider when it comes to punishment, four ends in mind. And the first is usually with punishment, it's rehabilitation. In other words, we want someone to change their ways. They've done wrong. We want them to recognize that they've done something wrong, that we'd like them to make amends or repent. Do everything in their possibility to make good on the damage or harm that they've done. If they've stolen money, we'd like them to return it and make good on that. That's the first point. But in relation to capital punishment, rehabilitation is foreclosed. Why? Because the person is dead. That person's been killed. So rehabilitation is an end of punishment that's no longer viable in the case of capital punishment. Although I will say, there have been occasions where someone facing the death penalty, the stark reality of that, the frightening possibility of being executed, can trigger a conversion experience. There have been plenty of instances in which someone might come to Jesus moment through the clarity of facing the death penalty. The second goal of punishment really is it's in self-defense in terms of defending society against someone, as I mentioned, that might be let loose, who, if they were back out in our communities, would likely commit further atrocities and crimes. In this case, the capital punishment is effective. It does stop there. Once the person's been executed, there's no more possibility of them being loosed back on society. So in that sense, capital punishment is effective. The third end in mind with punishment is deterrence. And that's an issue I think that comes up often, William, deterrence. And let's think about that, executions as deterrence. I think when you look at the social science, though, as you mentioned, there's 34 states that have capital punishment. I think that it's really inconclusive that capital punishment serves as an effective deterrent. Imagine us returning to a time where people were publicly drawn and quartered or some other gruesome, horrific way in which a person was executed publicly. Now, those sorts of scenes might prove to be a deterrent, but I don't think any reasonable person would advocate that that's where we want to go with capital punishment. Instead, we take great steps to make sure that it's done almost in private, silently, with as little pain and discomfort as possible.
Of course, some people would say that capital punishment would be a deterrent if the punishment was swift.
Well, there's certainly a calculus out there that there's an economic element to it, the cost of someone being on death row versus the cost of, say, long-term incarceration. But I think what you're talking about, William, though, is that it harkens back to almost like Westerns, right, where as soon as the deputy and his posse caught the wrangler, you know, who stole the cattle, it was the very next scene they were being strung up over a tree limb and being hung for their crimes right then and there.
And I was reading a Supreme Court case today. I want to say it was in Louisiana. But I was reading about this case that the recent Supreme Court, the Supreme Court now, ruled on in 2011. And it arises from a decision that was made in Louisiana in 1987. So the process of appeal for this young man has gone on for 24 years.
Yeah, they often last a very long time. And I would say last elements of punishment that it ends at, that punishment is aiming at is really this idea of retribution, that as the guilt of the individual goes up and the heinousness of the crime increases, we want the punishment to go along with that. Let me unpack that a little bit for you, because I think when we talk about someone who, let's say, has committed murder. As an example, someone's committed murder, someone has been tried by a jury of their peers, let's say they were given a good defense, the prosecutors were fair and open, they laid all the evidence out in a way that was amenable to the process.
And offered due process.
Now, these might be, we might argue later about whether or not that happens in real life, but for the sake of the scenario, to illustrate a point, a person's then found guilty of first-degree murder. Now, I would say that in that case, it still would be wrong to execute that person. And let me give you a few reasons why. I'd say first and foremost, executing a person who's executing another human being does not honor the dead. And it certainly doesn't ennoble the living. It may cool our anger for a time by executing the aggressor. But really, paramount in most people's minds, our hearts go out to the victims' families. And yet an execution may assuage their anger and the deep sorrow that they feel, but really what's needed is forgiveness and reconciliation. That's at the heart of it. I also would say that there is a moral cost, a moral price to be paid when we think about society, when it confronts a murderer, it's outraged by the violence. Yet that same society then turns around in a bloodletting, violence for violence. And that has a cost to it. I think that creates a certain callousness in our society. And I think it also begins to diminish the value that we place on the human person, because we have a category of people now that we say do not have the same worth, value, or dignity that you and I have by virtue of the crimes they've committed. Therefore, we're going to execute them.
You know, it's very interesting when we hear the concepts of forgiveness and reconciliation. I think we think in terms of some sort of soft solution, but these are the very ideas that people like Gandhi and Dr. King stood up for.
Absolutely, and those are great men who are animated by their faith. Now, when we began our conversation, William, I laid out sort of the common sense reasons why the human person has value and dignity. But I would also say that along with reason, there's also faith. And many people listening, myself included, have faith. And
you're talking about a spiritual faith.
A spiritual faith, a faith in a system of beliefs. Really, the major world religions give us a prism through which to view the world and from which we can draw certain conclusions. I stand in the Catholic tradition, and the Catholic Church has 2,000 years of reflecting on and promoting a culture of life. When we look at when we look at the theological dimension of capital punishment, many Christians will be able to find good reasons both in the Christian tradition, the framework of which Christianity operates, as well as in sacred scripture, as to the value of the human person being grounded first and foremost in the image and likeness of God, which is a supernatural reality, and also that each human person was created intentionally with a ultimate destiny for for each person to be with God in heaven forever.
But it's interesting that I think there's some research that shows that notwithstanding one's spiritual or religious orientation, that there's still a true power of forgiveness, be it if one was Hebrew or Jain or Buddhist or atheist even. If they could bring true forgiveness into a process that might involve someone in their family that's hurt or harmed in a heinous way, that if they can practice forgiveness, that there's some sort of possibility of restoration for them.
Well, it's interesting you bring that up. There's been a lot of work over the last 20 years, really beginning in the early 90s, in the area of psychology about forgiveness and its effect on the human person. And what we're finding out is that the when we bring together aggressors and their victims, where there's a possibility of forgiveness, that what happens is that the victim begins to find some closure. It's not, as you mentioned, like a soapy kind of mushy, you're okay, I'm okay kind of, but there's a stark reality of damage that's been done and has to be dealt with. And the way to do that is to seek forgiveness, forgive the other person, and that's how a person can begin to really heal from the trauma and damage from a terrible incident.
You know, we have here in Monroe County, we have the Center for Justice and Mediation, and it is built upon those principles. Community reconciliation creates a sort of a spiritual, at least a community healing. When victim and the aggressor can somehow find ways to help each other through a process.
And that I think is where a lot of the interesting developments are occurring. That you have on the secular side, if you will, something that many of the great spiritual traditions have recognized for a very long time. So you're right. Forgiveness is not. You know, a realm only for the spiritually minded, but rather it's something that's open to all of us as a possibility towards healing, a sense of well-being, closure, and that sense of getting our lives back on track.
And of course, the idea then is that with the death penalty, when it's actively practiced, that once the death penalty is applied, that restoration is over. That possibility is gone.
It really is.
Leaves a scar on the victim that then can never be restored, really.
Well, can never really be addressed.
That's right.
You never have the opportunity then to confront your aggressor, to tell them your feelings, tell them how it's impacted you. And you also, very interesting concept out there is one called reframing. Reframing is the notion of being able to hear the other person's frame of reference as to what may have transpired in their lives that led them up to the point. This is in no way to diminish their culpability or responsibility, yet every human person has a personal narrative. And by hearing and learning of that, we gain better understanding of one another. That doesn't let the other person off the hook by any stretch of the imagination, but rather brings us closer to a point of mutual understanding. And it's from mutual understanding that then the possibilities of forgiveness begin to emerge on the horizon.
I'm not sure how many of our younger listeners have seen this movie, but you and I have talked about the compelling story that's told in the movie Dead Man Walking from maybe 20 years ago, this movie is now. And we see in this movie how this sister, Helen Prejean,
mm-hmm.
struggles to help people on both sides of the death penalty issue. Those who are trying to seek some form of reconciliation and those who actively pursue, death as a measure of vengeance.
Well, and I think that our hearts really go out to the victims first and foremost, right? It's the pain, the grief is really unbearable when someone close to us.
Unspeakable.
Really, exactly. For someone close to us has been murdered and or otherwise violated. It's really unimaginable, as you said. And so it's totally understandable and a natural response that one of the first responses and a lasting response is one of anger, of a desire to see justice done, and a measure of retribution. And those things are not wrong to desire those things. Those are emotions aren't right or wrong. We have to feel our feelings. It's a matter of, though, how is justice best served? Once that person's been arrested for that crime, found guilty, they are now wards of the state. Right, they're now incarcerated, they're wards of the state. And so things begin to shift or change a little bit because now they're the vulnerable ones. They're the ones in the 7x12. I don't say that to invoke pity by any stretch of the imagination. The people have done heinous crimes. And yet there is this element of confinement and dependency that goes along with that. Simultaneously, it ought to raise a question in our minds about what is the role of the state and how much power do we want to give the state to administer the capital punishment? You and I both know that we could multiply the number of examples where people on death row who have been convicted of capital crimes through new technologies like DNA evidence have been found innocent. They were innocent. They've been in prison for a long time, long durations, and been found innocent. There's plenty of examples where there's been fumbled prosecutors at times maybe haven't been forthright or forthcoming with evidence or following the rules or suppressing evidence that should have come out. Think about who the defendants typically are. There is a great disparity between the number of minorities that receive death sentences compared to, say, white defendants. It's totally disproportionate. So what's going on there? I'm not making accusations of racism, but when you have a system in which you have step by step by step, example by example by example, where things have been mishandled wrong, and we're talking about someone's life, it's time for us to take a step back and reevaluate the whole process, the whole system.
I'm here with Timothy O'Donnell talking about the death penalty. Timothy, one last subject I want to delve into a little bit, and that's this recent execution in Texas of the mentally retarded Mexican national Humberto Leal. And of course, the Mexican government and the Obama administration pleaded with the state of Texas to hold it. Wait, don't execute him. There are issues still to be heard. This is almost a classic example of the death penalty, you know, why we should oppose this if there's a reason, you know.
I would agree with you because there's a irreversible finality once you execute a person. There's no going back. In the case of Humberto Leal, I think there's good reason to believe in his guilt, although clearly his side brought some questions up about that in his defense. But the rush to execute him again forecloses the possibility of further weighing it out. And now we have someone who's been executed, and we have a ripple effect in our society as a result of that.
Timothy, it's been great having you with us, and I hope you can come back to Interchange someday.
Well, the pleasure's all mine, William. It's really been a great grace to be here.
Great. Thank you very much.
Tonight in The Last Minute, Susan Norleaf talks about the cancer of greed.
America is sick. Just as people can get sick, so too can institutions, or in this case, a country. America has cancer. And unless we get treatment, she will die from it. With cancer, a few cells get out of control and start growing more rapidly than they should. They take more than their share of resources for themselves and their progeny. Eventually, they impinge on their neighbors and usurp space and food so that other organs of the body are compromised and unable to perform their proper functions. In the most malignant forms of cancer, the tumor itself causes new blood vessels to form and feed itself at the expense of the rest of the body. That is what is happening now in this country with the rich and super rich. There are two ways that this cancer is feeding itself. The first is by allowing large bonuses for heads of corporations. These bonuses are often in the tens of millions. Some CEOs get more money in 1 year than most people will earn in a lifetime. There is no rational way to justify this. It is driven by pure greed. When Ben and Jerry's ice cream first started, there was a corporate rule that the highest paid employee could not earn more than 7 times as much as the lowest paid employee. I think we should implement a sensible ratio for all wages in the United States. A second way of perpetuating this cancer is our unfair tax structure. By instituting tax breaks for the rich, money continues to be sequestered into the hands of a small percentage of individuals. This effectively prevents a sizable portion of our population from contributing to the economy. We have a large pool of creativity and talent that is being starved by not having access to employment. We either have to get rid of this cancer or it will kill us. We need to cut the cancer out. That is, get rid of the tax breaks for the rich and super rich, and we need to institute a healthy system of wage structures. America is sick, but I don't think it's our time to die. There are a lot of quacks in Congress. There are also a few good physicians, and I hope they will be able to win out and get us treatment before it's too late. We have to speak up and speak out. We're sick and tired, and we're not going to take it anymore. We're tired of being sick. For the last minute, I'm Susan Northleaf.
Thank you for listening to Interchange. Your thoughts and comments are always welcome. Drop us a line at interchange@wfhb.org. That's interchange@wfhb.org. Thanks to our assistant producer, Shane Young, for engineering tonight's program. Interchange is produced by William Morris. The executive producer is January Jones. Original theme music by Jamil Effiam, with additional music by the Miles Davis Quintet. And I'm Ashley Beeman. Thank you again for listening to Interchange. Stay tuned for Stardust with Tillman, coming up next on your community radio station, WFHB.
Real people.
Real issues.
This is your forum.
This is Interchange.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers working in the studios of Community Radio WFHB in Bloomington, Indiana.
Interchange fosters unfiltered open dialogue on the people, issues, and events impacting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Comments, suggestions, and program ideas may be sent directly to the Interchange staff.
The email address is news@wfhb.org.
That address once again is news@wfhb.org.